The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
You're probably wondering why I was asked to do this mighty conclusion of the book of Ezekiel. I have been wondering that too. At first I thought maybe it was some confidence on the part of Al Groves in my unerring sense of the meaning of prophecy. Or maybe it was simply a high regard for my extremely undeveloped homiletical ability. Or as is much more likely, am I here to provide a foil for all the previous speakers so that you can appreciate how good they were? Actually, the real reason is because I made a mistake. My original planned assignment was to do chapters 40 to 42, which is simply the measurements of the temple. Well, not being very bright and seeing that chapter and seeing only rods and cubits and wondering what I could possibly do with them, I asked Al for something else. Well, Al believes that if you ask somebody for his shirt, that you should give him your jacket also, so he gave me the whole conclusion of Ezekiel. Probably thinking that ought to satisfy him. So I've decided to go back to the original plan and talk about rods and cubits, which is more appropriate to my stature. First, though, let's take an overview of the whole vision to see how this temple measuring business fits in. Chapters 40 to 48 are the apocalyptic answer to the earlier desolation that's described in the earlier chapters. It is, if you will, the denouement that demonstrates that God has an ultimate goal and purpose, even in tragedies. Chapters 40 to 42 are this lengthy temple measurements and description. Chapter 43 is the return of the Lord's glory and the sacrifices, and that is kind of set over against chapter 10, where Ezekiel sees the glory of the Lord departing. Chapter 44 are the regulations for priestly service in the in this temple. Chapter 45, the first part, is the division of the land set aside for the temple area. 45b is the offerings. Then chapter 46 is the interesting chapter about the prince and his function and the gates that he goes in and the occasions that he enters, which gates and so forth, and his representation of the people. And chapter 47a is that very wonderful chapter about the river that comes out from under the temple and very rapidly grows quite deep and strong and brings life everywhere, and it flows down into the Dead Sea. And even in the Dead Sea, when it goes in there, it makes the salty water fresh so that fish are able to live there. And a great picture of the restoration of the true function of the people of God in the. And then the final chapters, 47b and 48, are the description of the divisions of the land, where each of the tribes is given a strip of land that runs from the Mediterranean all the way to the Transjordan. And then the last verse is the conclusion, which is the Lord is there, and Yahweh Shammah. And I think that there the conclusion is the main point to this whole end of the vision there. Of his vision, that the Lord is there, is that comforting message of the ending of Ezekiel. Now, all of this can be taken, and it usually is taken in one of three ways. Either is taken as literally with an immediate fulfillment in the restoration under Ezra and Nehemiah. The problem with that is, of course, that you'd have to do quite a bit of stretching of the materials in order to make it fit what happened under Ezra and Nehemiah. A lot of stuff there doesn't even have any counterpart in what happened under in the restoration, return from the exile under or shortly after Babylonian exile. Secondly, there's the literal interpretation that puts it all into the future after the Lord's return. The only problem with this is that that would mean, first of all, and most seriously, since it would involve a restoration of the bloody sacrifices. And that would be a direct denial, according to Hebrews, of the efficacy of Christ's work on the cross. And it's difficult to conceive why God would institute something that would be a direct denial of his work on the cross. Then the third way that it's sometimes taken is spiritually, in referring to the church, especially chapter 47, the river coming out from the temple is understood in this way. But then it's, you wonder why all these measurements and why all the very detailed explanations of the priestly activities and the offerings and so forth. So I think that none of these really fit very well. So I'll go on to the next page. My suggestion is that Ezekiel saw in earthly forms and using categories that he had experience with. Remember that Ezekiel was of a priestly family. Using experiences that he was familiar with, he saw a vision of the heavenly realities in the divine plan. And they were heavenly realities which then were reflected in history. It was kind of a heavenly typology, if you will. So we really have three steps that are involved here. First, his vision, which utilized forms and experiences of Ezekiel. That was a vision that was a reflection of, in terms that Ezekiel could understand, the divine plan in conception, the heavenly realities. And that then was later worked out in history, the divine plan realized in earthly realities. Now, I think we can't go directly from the first to the second to the third. We can't go directly from the earthly forms that Ezekiel saw to the earthly realities that later took place. You have to go by way of the divine realities that lie behind both. In the first instance, it was in terms that Ezekiel was historically familiar with. And then their later realization is a picture of is a reflection of the divine realities that are still there and are still operative even now, even though we don't have a temple. And with this in mind, we could go through these chapters, and I think it might be especially interesting to look at the figure of the prince in this regard, but I want to go back and consider the temple itself because that seems to be more well, if I make a mistake there, it's of less consequence. But consider the importance of the temple to the pious Israelites. First, the temple meant the presence of God. Historically and covenantally, it housed the reminders of this. It housed things like Aaron's rod that had budded. And covenantally, it held the ark itself, and the ark contained the tables of the law that had been given to Moses. So it established a relationship with this original covenant-giving activity of God with the people. And then even existentially, the Urim and the Thummim were kept there and represented a continual day-by-day kind of guidance for the people. So the temple was really a something that was of great spiritual significance to the people. It was also a reminder of God's great blessings in the past. It was a connection with the days of glory. The temple had been built by Solomon, of course, and just the fact that it was there established a relationship with what had gone on 400 years before. So it established that continuity with God's work in the past. But of course, in chapter 10, Ezekiel had seen the glory of the Lord depart. And historically, we know that Nebuchadnezzar completely razed the city, R-A-Z-E-D, and burned everything, including the temple. He knocked off the pillars and so forth. And so it really appeared that God had left. God was absent from his people. And that called the strength of the covenant into question. Ezekiel was faced with realities that produced in him what we might say cognitive dissonance. When I was in college, I went to college during the 60s. And in the 60s, everybody loved to take psychology. That was the thing to take. The reason being that you didn't have to learn anything in psychology. But I had to take psychology, and I didn't learn anything. But there was one thing that I still remember, and that is this discussion of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is simply when someone's assumptions or convictions clash with evidences that can't be made to fit. This is especially true with our understanding of people. If we gain a certain image of people, and we know them well, and then they do something that seems to clash with what we know about them, that produces a cognitive dissonance, a sort of disturbance in ourselves. I had a friend once that I had a very high opinion of. He seemed to be a remarkably God-loving man, used by God both in evangelism and in teaching the brethren, and someone who had a wonderful understanding of the scriptures and whom I had a great deal of respect for. And then he left his wife and family and ran away with somebody else's wife. And I still don't know how to relate to this guy. I have had very little contact with him since. And I still have some unresolved cognitive dissonance with relation to him. But think, what do we do if we have a cognitive dissonance with respect to God? Ezekiel, remember, had been put through a great deal. The Lord had even taken his wife away from him, just so God could make a point to Israel. And now God seems to have abandoned his people. What Ezekiel knew of God didn't seem to mesh with his experience. I'd like to ask you if you've ever felt any cognitive dissonance with regard to God, when it seems that God is not acting terribly concerned about you. Well, I have experienced that, and it really disorients your life. This possibility of cognitive dissonance in Ezekiel, and I don't want to necessarily read it into Ezekiel's character there, but Ezekiel was given a vision precisely to counter that possibility of cognitive dissonance. And the vision that he was given is a vision of the temple. And I think it must have meant a great deal to Ezekiel. Why else would he spend 3 chapters just describing this guy as the angel as he measures it? 3 whole chapters of cubits and rods is kind of hard to understand. But imagine what Ezekiel felt when he saw that angel measuring this temple. Here's reality. God has not abandoned his people. For here is the perfect temple. I can just see the tears in Ezekiel's eyes as he's watching with blurred vision, the angel measuring and counting the steps and so forth to this temple. To us, it's dry measurements. Who cares about cubits anyway? Or who cares how many steps led up to the east entrance? But you see, to Ezekiel, every one of those steps and every one of those cubits was proof of God's faithfulness. Now, some think that this was a blueprint that Ezekiel was giving for rebuilding the temple. But Ezekiel doesn't describe any rebuilding. He doesn't list any materials. Even the measurements themselves could be interpreted in various ways and making it difficult to kind of reconstruct anything more than a rough floor plan. So there isn't really here an architecture that's given. What does emerge is its dimensional perfection, as well as its reality, because I think the measurement itself, just the act of measurement, is something that reinforces its reality to Ezekiel. If it can be measured, it's something that we can grasp. So it was for him assurance that even though the Solomonic temple had been destroyed, God had not forsaken his people. There was a more permanent temple which already existed. Well, what serves for us is that kind of reminder. What serves for us that to remind us that although the earthly reflection of God's promises happens to be dim, that their reality is irresistible? What for us when we are in the midst of cognitive dissonance and God's acts in our lives seem to belie his love for us? What serves for us as a vision of a restored temple? Well, my suggestion is that these very apocalyptic visions that give us so much interpretive trouble. not just Ezekiel, but Daniel, and especially Revelation, overwhelm us with imagery, and whether or not, or to what extent, they are intended to predict actual future events, it all focuses on one particular truth, and that is that God is still there. Yahweh Shammah, God is there, and that he still rules, and that he has not forgotten you, and the future, whatever the details, will bear this out. And I can tell you that God does fulfill these commitments. The heaven realities which are stored up for us, they're not only future, they have a reflection, and they come, and they are reflected even though they're imperfectly reflected, they do have their counterpart in, even in our earthly life. There was a rebuilding of the temple. It wasn't a rebuilding of the perfect temple that Ezekiel saw, and in fact it was probably inferior, quite inferior to Solomon's temple, but it reflected the heavenly reality. God brought it to pass in remembrance of his covenant. It was not the ultimate fulfillment, but it was an earthly reminder that there is an ultimate fulfillment. And in our lives, God does restore our fortunes. And I mean even our earthly fortunes. Sometimes we get so concerned that we should concentrate only on the spiritual that we forget that the physical is, after all, a reflection of the spiritual and bears a relationship to it. And it serves as a reminder that he has in store for us an incomprehensibly greater spiritual fortune. Is God giving you difficulties and hardships? Well, you've got final exams coming up. I suppose most of you can say yes to that. But recognize that the same God who gave them to you is also going to overcome them, because the heavenly blessings are certain. Has God given you good fortune and felicitous circumstances? Well, let that be a reminder of the much greater spiritual blessings, of which they are but a pale and transient reflection. Don't allow the material blessings and the earthly blessings to divert you from the ultimate realities. But on the other hand, recognize that they are a reflection of those. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. And then you shall know that Yahweh Shammah. Let's pray.